This week on Art in the Air features beginning a career as a correspondent for United Press International, Carolyn R. Boyarsky. Later became a television news reporter, author, and professor of English discussing her book, Lead Babies and Poisoned Housing. Next, contemporary fiber artist Vicki Wheatley creating quilts with bold abstract designs and rich colors. Our spotlight's on the Center for Creative Solutions 2025 Poetry Showcase.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art in the Year Spotlight from the Center for Creative Solutions. And that, of course, is in LaPorte, but it's also going to talk about what's going on with the April celebration of World Creativity Innovation for 2025. There's a whole bunch going on. Cynthia Head heads that up and is also the founder of that organization. But also my co-host, Esther, is very much involved in this poetry project. And we'd like to turn it both over to them, and they can talk about what's going on that entire week. Cindy, welcome to Art in the Year Spotlight.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be back. About some real exciting events here and breaking some news with your audience and about some poetry things that are going on in Northwest Indiana, which we're real excited about. So just to get us started, mention that this is our ninth poetry showcase season, and we hope to engage students, all students throughout Northwest Indiana, as well as adults who are really poets and would like to share with us their creativity during World Creativity Innovation Week, which is April the 15th through the 21st of this year. But we do have events throughout the month celebrating creativity in its many different forms here in Northwest Indiana.
Well, you've been doing this now for decades with World Creativity and Innovation Week. How long has it been, Cindy? And can you sort of describe what the week is like and the different programs involved with it?
Well, thank you, Esther. Yes, the Center for Creative Solutions has been engaged with World Creativity Innovation Week for, I think, around 16, 17 years now. We were one of the first communities to recognize and try to organize our community around the theme of creativity every day for every person. And today, I am pleased to be able to say that there are over 140 countries throughout the world who are joining us for this celebration. So we're not alone. I will say that because we have been doing this for so long, we are very privileged because we have multiple events going on and things happening in April. So and many countries are just joining on, so they may sponsor one great event. but we have multiple events. So our goal is to create a culture of innovation and creativity throughout our communities here in Northwest Indiana, and the poetry showcase and the Poet Laureate efforts that we're going to announce today are really very exciting. And Esther, I know you've been involved for a long time, and your vision has been very valuable to us.
It's so exciting, Cindy, because we feature kindergarten through 12th grade and then added adults maybe 4 years ago, I guess. But we started with kindergarten through 12th grade, and the response has been tremendous from the schools, from the teachers, the principals, the community. It's really been embraced, and we've grown from grown tiny and just organically have grown. And now we have our judge, William Allegrezza from U of I, who's a magnificent poet and author. And, you know, he's been our judge now for a few years. So we're very grateful to have him. So yes. And I would love for you to make the announcement, though.
Well, we'll keep everybody's suspense, because I do want everyone to make sure that they know how to participate in all of this. And they can go to our website and submit their poem. And then, as I understand it, that goes to none of the names or background information goes to the judge. So it's totally independent.
Right.
And then he tells us who the winners are. And then on April the 27th, that's a Sunday afternoon, we want to invite everyone to the Poetry Showcase reading. And this is a great event, and it has truly grown. I think last year we had over maybe 100.
Over 100 people
that came, and they came from all over the region. And so that was really very exciting. It was not only the poets, but their families. And I have to confess that probably my favorite poets are the ones who are in the kindergarten, first grade, second grade, that the younger poets, because they are just amazing. And they are so composed. They are so enthused about being able to share their poetry. It's just delightful. And I hope everybody will be able to join us.
Right. Their spirit is infectious, actually. And they just are so pleased. And the audience is so pleased to hear from them as well. And so please visit the website to find out all the rules and regulations for the showcase. It's pretty easy for the elementary school, or for the K through 12. There are prompts on the website if you want to use those specific ones. Adults, this year we've changed the program to be very specific, to write poems about Northwest Indiana. And we've included all 6 counties in Northwest Indiana to participate.
Yeah, that's new. So let's make the announcement.
All right.
Laureate for Northwest Indiana, first time for youth and in the adult category, will be named. So,
right. Encompassing all of Northwest Indiana.
Yes.
Well, we thank you for coming on Art of the Year Spotlight and sharing about creativity. Center for Creative Solutions at Cynthia Hedge. The whole week is April 15th through 21st, and you can find out more at the website. Thank you so much for coming on Art of the Year Spotlight and sharing about creativity in Northwest Indiana.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Curtis L. Chrysler, Poet Laureate of Indiana, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Carolyn Boyarsky to Art on the Air. Carolyn is an investigative reporter, academic, and author. She began her career as State House correspondent for United Press International in 1964. She went on to become a television news reporter for the West Virginia CBS affiliate. She has published in The New Republic, and The Progressive, and various other newspaper Sunday supplements. Later, she became a professor of English at Purdue University Northwest, authoring 5 books. She also founded the Northwest Indiana Writing Project. Recently, she retired to return to writing with her latest book, Lead Babies and Poisoned Housing, being the result. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Carolyn. It's very wonderful meeting you.
Thank you so much for having me and talking about my book. I love to talk about it.
Well, we want to talk about you first, though. Our audience always wants to know about the background of our guests. I would say their origin story. So we want to hear how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Carolyn.
Well, I started out, I grew up in Philadelphia. And I wanted to be a teacher, just like my mother. Back in those days, that's what most women who decided they wanted to go to college decided to be. But I didn't really want to be a teacher. I went through being a veterinarian. That looked just great. However, I realized I can't stand the sight of blood and I would faint. This was not going to be a good profession for me. And when I was in junior high, I was an editor of the school newspaper. And at one point, my English teacher said, "Why don't you become a journalist, a reporter?" I had something I had never thought about. And I thought, that's perfect. It's just what I want. Except there were no women really in the field at that time. My model turned out to be Brenda Starr, who is a cartoon character for anyone who remembers. But that was it. I was determined. And when I graduated the University of Pennsylvania, I applied around for a job. Well, it was the same time that the reporters at New York Times had gone on strike. And so there were an awfully lot of men wandering around looking for jobs along with me. And it was really difficult to find one. Finally, I got an interview with United Press International. For those who don't know what that was the competitor to Associated Press, AP at the time. It has since gone out of business, and it wasn't my fault. At that point, went down, I was interviewed by the gentleman who was head of the Philadelphia UPI, and after interviewing me, he said to me, "Well, Bonnie, who was a former classmate of mine and a year older than me, we sent Bonnie to Baltimore and she's done okay. So we're willing to give you a try." That's mm-hmm. how difficult it was in those days for a woman to get a job. Wow. But I went down there and apparently I did okay. 2 years later, I got an offer to do do television news for the CVS affiliate in Charleston, West Virginia, which was where I was with UPI. And so I became a TV newscaster, reporter, and one of the very few in the country. There were almost none at the time that I was doing it. Nancy Robinson, for anyone who remembers, Nancy Dickerson, her son John Dickerson has since become a known personality in TV news, but she was the first who really was known doing television news. And let's see, from there, I did get married. I married one of the men I was covering at the State House. He was a deputy commerce commissioner. He eventually left the State House in West Virginia and began his own business as selling aircraft. And that, by the way, was how I wound up getting a pilot's license. But he wound up also getting jobs around the country, being offered better jobs where he could make more money. And so I wound up traveling around the country, left television news, left actually investigative reporting, and began to do public information, especially in terms of educational organizations. I did information for the White House Conference on Youth in 1971 in Washington, D.C., which was quite exciting. And I was under President Nixon, but I was a Democrat, but it didn't matter. We were a group of young people under the age of 30 who were meeting with people around the country, bringing in young people and finding out what that generation wanted to do, to be, and wanted the country to do for them. We went back to Kennedy as what, ask not what this country can do for you, but what can you do for this country?
And that's, you know, Carolyn, you sound like Brenda Starr. I think you did lead the Brenda Starr life.
That sounds wonderful. I'm just a blonde and she's a redhead. But that's,
well, you know, those.
I'll take that. I'll take that acceptance. Yes. Eventually, I decided I wanted to have a family. And being an investigative reporter, running around doing even public information was a lot. So I decided to go into the academic world. I went back to the universities and got myself a doctorate degree and eventually wound up here in Hammond, Indiana, teaching at Purdue University, what then was Calumet, what is now Purdue University Northwest. I was a professor of English and taught there for close to 30 years. And then retired. And just before I retired, I found out about what was going on in East Chicago and decided I was going to go back to my investigative reporting and I would retire and write a book about what I thought was a horrific but fascinating story.
You know, and we'll pick up on that a little bit later, but I want you to tell a story about when we talked yesterday about like when you wrote a story, and I think that's when you were in West Virginia, and then I don't know if the network was going to pick it up, but you couldn't read your own story. Tell us a little bit about that. And also some of the other challenges women had in that era.
Well, aside from getting a job in the first place, that was when I was doing TV news. And the best thing you could do was, I was local news. I was with the local station in Charleston. But the best thing that could happen to you was if the network thought there was a story you were doing that they wanted to put on the network. And I can't remember what the story was, but I got on the phone when they called to ask for the information and gave it to them. And yes, they decided they wanted to do it. And if you even see it happen now on television, where the news goes to the local reporter and the local reporter reports the information. And they said, we very much want to do the story. Is your director around? It, who was Ed Rabel, who eventually did wind up on CBS. And so Ed, I had to get Ed to come in and tape the story because they didn't want me to do it. And Ed and I decided since I had written it, we would share the amount of money they gave us.
Wow.
There were other stories too. While I was doing TV news, that was during the Vietnam War, somebody came on the phoned me and said, how can a woman tell the story of the war? You shouldn't be on talking about war. And I had a quick answer. I said, women are more, should be on that more than men. We're the ones that bore the children that are out there fighting. So that was definitely one of the stories. I remember covering a story about a union meeting. Well, there were almost no women in any union at the time. I walked in and it was an entire auditorium filled with men. It was an eerie, strange feeling that I was the only woman where there were really, I think, several hundred men in the area. That too has changed a lot. And everything has changed so considerably. One of the things that amazed me was that there was recently a woman appointed the executive director of the Northwest Indiana Times. And I thought that was just amazing that where I had trouble just getting a job as a reporter, she had been appointed as the executive director of a newspaper. I just was so proud.
Well, but it's your tenacious spirit that led the way.
Yes, I was absolutely determined to do it. I think some of that determination disturbed my parents. But other than that, I'm very glad that I pushed forward. And so many women like me at that time began to push forward. Andrea Mitchell, who's on CBS, attended University of Pennsylvania shortly after I did. And she's another one from the University of Pennsylvania who has really done a fantastic job of indicating what women can do in the field.
Were your parents activists or advocates? I mean, is that where you got that urge to investigate and to push forward?
No, I think I was just determined. You can't tell me, because I'm a woman, I can't do something. I was there to prove I could. Why shouldn't I? And as I said, my teacher had to become a journalist, and it really was what I wanted to do. And I didn't want anybody to stop me. I was going to figure out how to have a family, how to also have a career. I was determined.
Well, and that's even in the public broadcasting field. With like NPR, you had Susan Stromberg, Linda Wertheimer, Nina Totenberg, who went on to television, and Cokie Roberts, actually. They all were kind of founding members of the NPR whole news cycle of that. And they were early founders, women founders. And I think they had maybe a little easier door because people didn't regard public broadcasting at that time as anything that good. But they all became major players in that.
So. Absolutely.
One quick question and with your experience, if there was especially a young woman, but I guess this could apply for a man, what advice would you get if they want to go into like news reporting, whether it be print or broadcasting? What advice would you have for them?
Right now, I'm not sure because I don't know where the news profession is going. My feeling is it's going entirely to digital, and which might be easier to have do both digital and raise a family, right, which was what I wanted. I don't think women in those days, it was if a woman had a career, she wouldn't have had a family. And that was ridiculous. I was determined to have both, and I did. And I think women, men, going into journalism today, I hope, will continue to have the kind of investigative minds that we had back when the press was read as a newspaper. I just read an article today where their paperback has pretty much gone out of print, that publishers are only publishing hardbacks, or mainly publishing hardback. And I found that with the book, this book, Babies and Poisoned Housing. They did a hardback book. They then went on to do an ebook, but they did not do a paper book. Wow. And what I've noticed also is that hardback books can be purchased for cheaper than paperback books, which is just the opposite of what when I was growing up. And
right.
Yes. So I think it's a very changing profession, and I'm just not sure where things are. But I have met a number of member of the Society of Environmental Journalists, and there are quite a few men and women that are involved in there, mostly doing freelancing. Back in the day, I couldn't do it. I couldn't make enough money. I didn't see how to do that and make enough money to raise a family, send a child to college. But they seem to be doing it. So I think the whole field is changing. But we in this country need journalists. We need people that tell the truth, the real facts, that can combat and provide the information that's out there, where people can go and know they're getting trustworthy information.
And that doesn't exist so much. You have a lot of news outlets that are maybe sounding boards for various point of views. And you're right, the having good and people criticize mainstream journalism, but you need that investigative level to bring the true facts forward. And, you know, there's people out there or news organizations that don't do that. They're basically propaganda for different views.
This is one of the reasons we need public radio. We need public television because they continue to provide both sides. They continue to fact find. They hire the reporters that really want to get the information and look into it and make sure, fact find. I remember we returned.
Dig deep.
Yes. And I think this is still holds. We had to have two sources behind anything that we had found out so that we were knew that what we were reporting was supported by the fact.
So while you were teaching at Purdue, you were a very prolific writer then, writing like 6 books, but academic books.
Well, we did some interesting things with those books, too. That was when they were looking at beginning to research how do people write. Up till then, if you were taught writing, it meant basically you taught grammar, punctuation. And that's not what writing is all about. Writing is about information and providing information to people and communicating that information to people. That means that, yes, grammar is important, because it helps communicate information. If you don't have a comma someplace, it might actually create a problem. You can't figure out, is that 3 things or 2 things they're talking about?
Right.
But the truth of the matter is, when I was growing up, I was sent to an elementary school that was the lab school for Temple University in Philadelphia. And they never taught grammar. In the entire time I was going to school in Philadelphia, I went to public school for junior high school. I went to public school for high school. The only grammar I ever learned was when I learned French. But I learned how to write. I learned how to tell stories. I learned how in journalism, I was on the school paper all the way through, how you put the important information at the beginning, how you think of who is your audience, what is it that they need to know?
Yeah, the titles are so interesting. I'm actually going to pick up Risk Communication and Miscommunication. It just sounds like such a good book.
That's where I went back to investigative reporting. I wrote about the Columbia and Challenger explosions, the Gulf BP explosion. I was somewhere one time and somebody asked me, what do I do? And I was telling them what I wrote about. They said, don't you ever write about anything good? So I wrote about the Mississippi flood because people in 2010, and people did write enough to keep farmers from having their farmlands flooded, from having the cities flooded that were along the Mississippi, at least in the northern part of the Mississippi, were saved basically because the information went out there in the right way.
Right.
Well, I read that you wrote Lead Babies. You were chasing another story when you came upon this one. So what I can't remember quite, though, what you were investigating when you came across this story.
Well, as I've said, I wrote about disasters, and I had read about the Flint, Michigan disaster.
Flint, Michigan, right.
And I was looking for, was there a memo, was there a letter that had gone out warning about the problems in the water? And I didn't find that, but what I came across was the letter that was written by the mayor of the city of East Chicago, basically forcibly evicting the victims, the residents of the West Calumet housing complex, where they had found lead under the homes. And as I began to look into that, I discovered the EPA had known about it for 35 years and done nothing. There were people whose children were developing ADHD, which is a result of lead poisoning. It affects young children more than any others. There's a story in the book about how Akeisha Daniels, one of the residents, discovered black dust on her bathtub. And she went to the housing authority and said, I've got this black stuff on my bathtub. And they said, you need to keep it cleaner. And one of the problems is that those kinds of agencies often blame the people rather than themselves for what they did not maintain. What they found was that the bathtub had no flooring under it. Oh. It was laid on plain dirt.
Wow.
Yeah, it was astonishing. And what she discovered was this was done on all the houses on her block. They were trying to save money. Some of that money was going into everybody's pocket at the time. Oof. And that was one of the stories. There are many stories in that book like that.
And unfortunately, we're going to run out of time for you to read it, but we want you to give you an opportunity to say how they can find the book, Lead Babies and Poisoned Housing. And also, you have an event coming up where you're doing a reading, I think, in Valparaiso. Tell us about that.
They can order it on Amazon. They can get it from order it on Barnes & Noble. The new Barnes & Noble here in Schererville has it. And I will be doing a keynote speech at 9:30 in Valparaiso at Valparaiso University on March 29. And then on April 19, I will be doing a book signing at Miles High Books in Highland.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate you coming on the show and sharing about not only your book, but your wonderful career. It's just wonderful to share that with our audience. That's Carolyn Boarski, the Lead Babies and Poisoned Housing. You can find her book there, and she's available on LinkedIn and also on Facebook if you want to find out a little bit more about Carolyn. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your wonderful life journey.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you. It was an excellent book.
Art of the Year listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Peter Marks, former theater critic of the Washington Post, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome Vicki Wheatley to Art on the Air. Vicki is an award-winning contemporary quilt maker out of Louisville, Kentucky. She strives to have her work capture the feelings of vibrancy, energy, and anxiety that swirl around and within us as we experience life. She calls these quilts inner architecture. She uses the techniques of strip piecing, slicing, and restructuring to express her feelings. Her quilts have been juried into a variety of exhibitions in Indiana, Kentucky, and New York. She is a member of the Louisville Area Fiber and Textile Artists and a juried artist member of Studio Art Quilts Associates, and is also an avid bird watcher. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Vicki. It's so nice to meet you.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, Vicki, all of our guests want to know what we want to know about your background. I'd like to say your origin story. How you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Vicki.
Okay, well, I'm going to start before Vicki with my family, because my dad's family and my mom's family were both from East Tennessee. They lived in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains. Dad lived on the wild side, his family, and mom was on the quiet side in Blount County. Dad was in Newport area. But both of their families lived in that area since before the Revolutionary War. So they're, you know, I've come from a long line of very people who are isolated and so very resourceful and very independent. If they
pioneering.
Needed, yeah, I mean, really, you know, yeah. So they made everything. They made clothing, their homes, their furniture. Some, not my family, other families made moonshine. And so we just You know, my parents left that area. Dad was in World War II, and when he got out, he went to the University of Tennessee on the GI Bill. And my mom was encouraged by a teacher to join two of her classmates and go to the University of Tennessee to the nursing program, 4-year registered nurse program. So that's where they met. And they were married in 1953, and I was born a couple of years later. So that's how I got to the birth part. but that's very important for two reasons. One is that they were makers, and two is that sense of place. And although I never lived in East Tennessee, I have been there so many. I mean, you know, we went back, the cousins were there, everyone was there. Granddad's house, was there, and we visited all the time. So it is a beautiful, incredible natural area, and that is one of the things that I love and I feel connected to from there.
So, what kind of activities were happening? So, what were you visually aware of, especially in the realm of making things as you were growing up? Like, did all the cousins get together and go out and, you know, get into adventures?
Well, we went camping in the Smokies. We visited Gatlinburg a lot. We camped. Dad and his brother both had motorhomes or trailers, but they started off with camping trailers and they graduated over the years to motorhomes. And so we traveled to the East Coast and into Canada and out west. And so that was, you know, a time that we, yes, were out in nature and was out in, you know, one of the things about mom and dad both is that dad had a job where we moved about every 3 years. So that was kind of cool. It was, you know, it's a little bit hard sometimes to shift gears and move to a new place. But one of the places that was very instrumental in my love for the outdoors was when we moved to Simpsonville, Kentucky. And Dad rented, we rented a big house on a 400-acre working dairy farm, Black Angus cattle farm, tobacco bays, hay fields, and he bought me a pony. So I was free to go. There was a dinner bell outside the house, so I could go wherever I wanted to go, stay as long as I wanted to stay. And again, the fields, the streams, the lakes, walnut trees, the dragonflies on the pond. It was, you know, I collected rocks and feathers. And so that was a pivotal time. And we were only there about 3 years.
I don't know. There's a book. That's a book. You just described a wonderful book, Vicki.
I wrote a short story about it once because I taught middle school and I was teaching kids how to write a little memoir. So I did write a little short story about it, but I don't know if I have a book in me. I think I want to work through quilts.
Yeah. You know, but actually that does bring up, I did read about the writing projects you developed with your students and how one of them wound up in Chicken Soup for the Teen Soul. That's pretty exciting. And both of you got to read your stories on the radio. That's like, what a wonderful thing to do for your students, because I think your students said that you know, part of the assignment was they had to submit it, their work, to be published. It was a great experience.
Right. We did a lot of writing. Words were very important to me. When I was in, and I wanted to share that love of words and writing, I think they surprised themselves when they were, you know, selected to be in a magazine or in a book. So, but anyway, so words, yes. In Morristown, New Jersey, we were in Simpsonville, and then we moved. I was in the third grade or sixth grade by that time, and then we moved to Morristown, New Jersey. Dad was working in New York City at the home office at that time. And quite a shock. This was in the late 60s, early 70s. So to go from Simpsonville, Kentucky to Morristown, New Jersey, right outside of New York City, was culture shock, to say the least. But I loved it. The education system was fabulous. So at one point in high school, I was reading The Red and the Black by Stendhal in French. I was reading The Flowers of Evil by Baudelaire, the poetry, in French. In Latin, we were reading Aeneid. And in my language arts class, and I had a crackerjack language arts teacher, she was awesome, we were reading Richard Wright's Native Son. So words and what I see, you know, the visual landscape, the natural landscape mostly, but I love cities too. You know, you can look at windows and reflections in windows and doors, and, you know, there's just a lot out there to take in.
Yeah, and they're reflected in your quilts, actually, all those scenarios.
So how many years did you teach, and was it all middle school that you taught?
I started off teaching middle school, and then that was probably, 3 or 4 years. And then when my son was born, I went back to work, but decided that that is not what I wanted to do. So we tightened our belts and I quit working for 7 years. And during that time, I fell back onto the traditions of my family and I made everything in the house that needed to be made. Curtains, I reupholstered furniture, stenciled floor cloths for rugs, you know. I also got interested in embroidery. I joined the Embroiderers Guild and did a lot of hard anger and pulled thread. And, you know, so the making part was very strong at that point. And then
was it strong growing up in the household too? I mean, were you like in close contact with your grandma and No.
My dad's mother died when she was in her 40s. Mm. We lived in Simpsonville and then in New Jersey. And so it was a long way to East Tennessee. So we did go, around Christmas time or Thanksgiving and in the summer. You know, in the summer is when we would travel around with Uncle Everett and his kids, my cousins. And so we saw them, but not, I didn't grow up with them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, mom was making everything in the house and all my clothes until, you know, the dress code was you had to wear dresses. So as long as we wore dresses, she made them. And then, thank goodness, in high school at some point, they did away with that. And, faded blue jeans with holes in them came into vogue. I did embroider on those and, you know.
Yeah, me too.
I remember when the school I was at, when they first were allowing jeans, the big discussion was, but they can't have those metal studs on it because they'll damage the furniture of the school. And I'm like, and you look at these desks and like, these are from like the 1940s. Are you kidding me? What damage are they going to do?
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Well, it's funny, the dress code, you know, because when we were wearing those dresses, they were mini skirts. And so really, I think they changed the dress code to pants, you know, and jeans just to protect us all from ourselves.
They were almost wide belts at that point. So,
right.
After you did the 7 years, did you go back to teaching?
I did. Let me think. I went to elementary school because my kids were in elementary school and we lived, you know, 5 minutes from an elementary school. And I was no longer working in Louisville or living in Louisville. We were out in Oldham County where we had 7 acres and a horse. And so, I went back as an elementary school teacher and I taught everything because I was of that age. They grandfathered, you know, now you have to have specialties for each grade level or section. But at that time I was grandmothered in, I guess, as K through 8, I could teach anything. So I taught, kindergarten, first grade, second, third. And then I did that for a while and then moved back to middle school teaching language arts and social studies. And I did that through 2011, you know, so I went back to work. My daughter was 6, and so that would have been about 89, 90, and worked until 2012 and then retired.
Do you have a favorite grade to teach?
Oh, that's a good question. It depends on the day, you know, because
that is the truth.
It was not kindergarten. It was not kindergarten. I taught kindergarten for two or maybe the third year is when it happened. And for some reason, we had 40 kids in the class. Oh. I had 40 kids to start school. They got that worked out, but it took a few weeks. And they're five-year-olds, and they've never been to school, and they need you. And I could not get their attention unless I sang. And I am not a good singer, but, you know, good enough to get their attention and get them, you know, whatever I sang, they would listen to. And then I thought, I'm not doing this again. I'm going to make it through this year, and then I'm going to go to a little bit older. But I love the middle school mostly. You know, they've got hormones going on, and some days they act like kindergartners, and some days they're just wonderful. But you can do so much with them, and the writing, and the, you know, I had people come in to work with them, artists to come in, and especially with poetry and writing, and I just love that. I love seeing what someone who from the outside who wasn't their everyday teacher could really get out of them as writers. It was wonderful.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM on WVLP 103.1 FM.
So a middle school presents the same kind of challenge. They're kids, and yet they want to be adults. It's sort of a transition period there, but it's also a very creative period. There's having worked with both high school and middle school myself, and I know that middle school age, there's something about the energy level that they have that they want to bring to the table.
Yes, that's very true.
It takes a lot of creative energy to teach. So when you got home, did you have enough left to continue with your own personal art practices? And when did you start to express through the quilts, I guess?
I made clothes mostly. I loved the fabric, and my mom sewed. And so that's what I did to express my creativity. I did use patterns, but I picked out, you know, the fabrics and everything. I made a small quilt wall hanging for some friends. I loved I could afford like 1 yard of Liberty of London prints. They're just these beautiful prints from Bear Fabric, a wonderful fabric store in Louisville. And so with the scraps, I made a little wall hanging that looked like a mid-century modern kind of thing. And it was really quite good, but it was the only time that I made a quilt without a pattern until I retired. And when I retired, I guess this happens, you know, maybe to a lot of people, but along the way, I always had in my mind that I was an artist. I mean, I took entomology at the University of Kentucky, and we were supposed to be learning how to, you know, kill bugs. But I was looking at books of them and thinking, these are so beautiful, the patterns, you know, and I would sketch out some of the patterns and think, I'm going to use this someday. Yes, I always had in my mind that I wanted to express, you know, my unique vision of the world somehow. Poetry. I wrote a lot of poetry in college. So I thought it might be that. But I don't know. I got enamored and taken with quilts because of the G's Bend quilts, the G's Bend quilters were in Alabama, a group of Black women who made these gorgeous big quilts with big patterns, you know, very modern contemporary, you know, and they had their, very graphic. And I loved that. And then my friend and I here in Louisville, also a retired teacher in about 2012, started going to a wonderful national quilt show in New Albany, Indiana, called Form Not Function. And I saw the most beautiful quilts, and the ones that I was attracted to were the ones with great big shapes and rich color. And so I thought, I want to make quilts like that. And I started teaching myself with my friend, Karen Buckingham, to dye our own fabric. We studied shape and color and line. and we joined a little quilt group called No Name, No Name, because it was just a small group, but very talented in many different ways. And so we really developed our skills, techniques, and love of that dyeing fabric. It is just such a delight to see those treasures of fabric that come out after you dye them. And then I made a little bit bigger quilt and in that Nonami group, and a local artist, he's a local hero, really, Bob Lockhart, who came to our group to help us with critiquing. And he pulled me aside and he said, "You've really got something. You really are good." So I was like, wow, like he's bona fide, you know, he's a real artist. So, you know, that was all it took. And then my husband started showing my, I don't know if I ever would have, he started showing my work to local galleries in town, and they all just accepted my work. And one of them, I had several solo shows there. So that got me started. You know, Jesse Jackson said, if you can conceive it and you believe it, you can achieve it. And so I told my husband, I said, I'm an artist, you know, and, you know, I think if you live like an artist where you're engaged with the world and you're always looking to bring home, you know, it's like a little crow. You see what's out there, it's bright and shiny, and you collect it and you bring it back and you might be able to use it sometime. And so Ellsworth Kelly said the same thing. He was in New York City with, you know, his early work, and he would see a shape, because he just did very simple shapes, and he would say, "I want that." And so he would draw it and sketch it and make it his own. And I feel like I'm kind of the same way.
Does every quilt incorporate your hand-dyed work? Is that a major component of what you're doing now?
No, and the reason I stopped, and not every quilt, I say every quilt probably has a little bit of it. It used to be all hand-dyed. I had to change when I went to study with Nancy Crowe, who's like the guru of contemporary art and design, and she required so much fabric for you to bring to these workshops that I had to buy it. And it's fine. Especially in those anxiety quilts with all that texture and all that cut up into little tiny pieces, it just doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Now I'm finally ready with my solo show that's coming up to show the anxiety quilts and close that door for now and always return. But I am making big shapes right now, and so I may return to hand dyeing fabric because that makes a big difference in them.
For your quilts, what gives you the inspiration? You sort of touched on that, but an event in your life, or, you know, tell us about what says, okay, that's going to make me do this.
Yeah, tell us about your anxiety.
Well, here's the thing. When I started that anxiety quilt, I was just, you know, exploring, playing around in the basement and, you know, trying out different things. And I came up with a block that I liked that had a very strong black and white diagonal pattern. And I put that together and I loved it. And I started to quilt it in just straight lines. But some of the lines were a little bit off. They weren't perfect. So I was going to enter it into this quilt show, Form Not Function, that I had loved so many years before and said, about 5 years before, and said, I want to get into the quilt show. And so I call it Anxiety's Imperfections because, you know, there were imperfections. Yes, but all those anxieties, but here's what I said about it. I'll just read it if that's okay.
Yes, please.
I am thinking about the structure that makes up our lives, the laws of physics and nature, the forms of our governments, the working of our minds, our daily routines, grand cities of civilization, past and present, and how these structures do not remain fixed. They give way to the slow accretion of time, or they are shattered in an instant. Natural disasters, war, a powerful idea. The question is, what remains and what new structures will form? And so that's my quilts. I make a structure and then I start covering it up with thread and little bits of fabric and cut it into pieces. And it's a frenetic process, and it's a frenetic quilt.
Are these large quilts or are they all sizes?
They are medium to large. And by large, I mean, you know, 5 to 6.5 feet, you know. And a lot of them are 4.5 to 5 feet.
You know, we're getting in our final moments here, and I'm going to give you a chance to tell us about your solo show, about when it is and where it is and how people can see it, and if there's availability to see it online.
Yes, the solo show is March the 14th through May the 10th. The opening is March 15th from 5:30 to 7:30. It's at the Harrison County Arts Center, and you can you can look at my website, VickiWheatley.com, to see my quilts. That are most of those quilts are on the website that you'll see at the show. And I just want to tell everybody, work local. You know, you can enter big shows nationally and all that kind of stuff, but this was a local show. I entered it. It was not a quilt show. It was a fine art show. And I won best in show. And with that came money, actual money. And I didn't even have to give them my quilts and a solo show. So I believe in, act locally.
We appreciate you coming on Art in the Air, Vicki Wheatley. You can find her at VickiWheatley.com. And of course, if you go to our website and click on her picture, that will take you there. And her show opens March 14th with a reception on the 15th, running through May if you're in the area. Thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your arts journey.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you. It was such a pleasure. Thank you, Vicki.
Thank you, Esther. Thanks, Larry.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell it to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker, and for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at AOTA@breck.com. That's AOTA@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Show the world your heart, express yourself through art, and show the